Our sponsor today is none other than our Patreon members. You folks are bringing swords and HEMA to listeners worldwide, so thank you. To support our work and receive exclusive benefits, visit patreon.com/swordwomen. Welcome to By the Sword, where we discuss the modern study of historical European martial arts, or HEMA, with instructors, experts, and martial artists from all over the world. In this episode, I speak to Martin de Jong of the Netherlands, also known as the Kleiwang Fencer. We talk about the history of the Kleiwang and its use in the former Dutch colonies, as well as his upcoming book. The episode was recorded on Instagram Live, 25th August, 2021.
Hi there, Martin.
Good evening.
Good evening. It's been a while. We had to keep rescheduling this, but we're finally here. So it's lovely to have you.
We're both a little bit busy lately, so.
Yeah, with good reason. Tell us what you've been up to. Because you had a memorial service, didn't you?
I got a new job.
Yeah.
So that's a first. And what we are being up to, we had on the August of 15th, there was a Memorial Day, globally, except for the Japanese. Because it was, how do you call it? Well, you have victory over Europe, a victory in Europe, but you have victory in Asia. Or something like that. The Netherlands, we commemorate the end of World War II in Asia. So that was also a very busy, period, because you had to practice, of course. And Anouk and I were honorary guards at one of the memorials. And it was a little bit how you call it. Anxiety, because we've never done that before, and because it was also on in Amsterdam on the National Monument. There were certain people, certain celebrities over there, and it was special. And of course, I am Dutch and I am half Moroccan, so that day is also a very very important day to me. And basically that is what we were up to a couple of weeks.
Moroccan is the Dutch word for people of Indonesian descent. Is that correct?
The Moroccans. There is a group of islands in eastern Indonesia near Papua New Guinea, and it's called the Moluccan Islands. And the half of my family are from over there. And that's a really big story, a long story, complicated story, unfortunately. But my grandfather and his brothers were soldiers of the KNIL, the Royal Dutch Indies Army. And that was a colonial army, because the Dutch in Indonesia was until 1950 a colony of the Netherlands. My grandfather and his brothers and also other relatives were soldiers in that army, and Indonesia got independent. There were a little bit of struggles, and suddenly at one point it was decided that my grandfather and his brothers-in-arms had to move temporarily to the Netherlands to settle things and let the situation cool down, and then we can go back. But 70 years later, we are still here. So
you're still there.
We are still here in the Netherlands.
Netherlands.
Long, complicated story. But
have you been back to Indonesia ever?
No, but I really want to, because I have family over there. And I really want to meet them. And yeah, because of these 70 years we are now in the Netherlands, and the growing attention and interest in our past, it's also interesting to me. And I was already busy in my teens with this subject, but now it got more interested, and now I have the ability and the opportunity, and of course finances, to actually do stuff and do things about it. For one instance, I'm now learning Bahasa Indonesia. It's the Indonesian language on Duolingo.
Cool.
So I can communicate with my relatives, but also with colleagues and friends in Indonesia I made in a couple of years. And also to speak my other native language. Well, not really Bahasa Indonesia, but Malayan Bahasa, a mixture of that. So I can talk to people over there and people over here.
Cool.
Besides Russian English.
Now, you of course, this is a HEMA podcast, HEMA channel, and this is, you're in a quite a unique position as a martial artist, because you're of Asian descent, living in Europe, learning European martial arts, and through your learning historical European martial arts, you have, I mean, we're going to go into your story in a minute, rediscovered your heritage, the weapons of your forebears, Indonesia. So this has been a very interesting kind of discovery for you. But let's start with the historical European martial arts. Initially, so tell us how you got into HEMA. That's not the department store from the Netherlands, folks. The
in the Netherlands we have a department store called HEMA.
How did you get into historical European martial arts? How did it happen?
Well, I started practicing HEMA in 2015, and it was after a period of, I used to be a football player for many years, and then at a certain age, your knees start to give in. So you got injured, and your football career is over. And then I start to dab in other sports, and to do maintenance of your own body. I did some fitness, of course, just to keep up. And at a certain moment, I went to a fantasy fair with my best friend and his wife and small child.
Yeah.
And there I saw a couple of guys and a couple of girls sword fighting. And
I'm still here. My dog is just being a pain. She wants to go and bark at things, so I'm trying to stop her. So you went to the event and you saw some people practicing. What were they practicing?
Well, they were doing longsword. That was there were two schools over there. So one is a school from Rotterdam, and the other one was a school in Utrecht. And the school in Rotterdam was a more competitive kind of school. Mm-hmm. And Zwarte Steen.
Yes.
And they were fencing with long swords. And mm-hmm. the other group was called Noorderwind. And they are now called Bataille. And what's the other group split up? Vanguard. The Bataille is the the stage combat group more attached to HEMA, and Vanguard is more the professional stunts people. Both of the groups did some stunt work, did some fighting scenes for the movie Michiel de Ruiter a couple of years ago. So yeah, that's very cool. But I joined too late for the movie.
Oh.
I still have those weapons. So after talking to both of the schools for an hour and a half, and I just thought it was 15 minutes, but and they said, well, okay, cut the crap, sign in for a tryout lesson and join the group. So yeah, basically I did. And May 2015, I joined the HEMA community. And a couple of months later, I did the stage combat. And yeah, that's the start of my HEMA career. So it's 6 years already.
6 years. Wow. Where does the time go?
Time flies.
So you thought it was 15 minutes. It was an hour and a half. You thought it was a quiz. It's been 5 years. So, you know, you started out in like battalion, like they do a lot of very theatrical, very showy, demonstrative fighting. And I know that that's something you and your partner Anouk have taken part in like reenactment fairs, things like this. And then there's the other kind of side of HEMA is the very competitive, sporty side. I guess with your soccer background, that must appeal to you as well.
Yeah, I really like the both because I'm very I was very competitive. I'm still competitive, but not that very that competitive anymore. And my my family was also very sports minded. Though the women in my family were doing sports at high levels. Some of my, my male relatives were competing at high levels. So yeah, I for me too. And I just wanted to do some stuff, and also in martial arts. And my father was Hapkido, second black belt Hapkido, for instance. So the martial arts thing I really enjoyed. And usually I was the test dummy of my father. So
the test dummy.
And I have seen every corner of the house when he came back from hey. I've learned some new moves. Okay, show me. Bang in that corner. Bang in that corner. Bang in that corner. And my mother, nice, cool down.
So
but,
you
never,
you didn't do any classes yourself? You didn't do any martial arts before HEMA?
No, but I've done some boxing for 2 years on a recreational level. That was very, very fun, but not martial arts before, like HEMA. And cool. Now I even picked up Eskrima.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
I really got into the stick fighting and knife fighting and close combat thing. Yeah, and what concerns the stage combat, I really like to also do shows and demonstrations because, yeah, well, on stage combat, now you have to make those big moves, and you can't do those really nice, fancy, small moves when disarming and grappling and stuff because the people can't see. Because you have to make those very big moves. So yeah, I really like both sides.
Do you think you'd ever want to go into movie work, working in the film?
Well, really should be nice to do it because, but well, yeah, well, never say never.
Because I think you've got a very good, like, you've got a very good look for like a historical, some kind of historical movie about with swords in it. I think you'd be really good.
Yeah. Oh, and Anouk and I did some, well, movie work, but not really movie work like actors, but we were part of a, well, we had to do fencing, small sword fencing. Well, like small sword fencing, but it was really, but it was really about the camera techniques and the software they were using because it was we were fencing. We had to do some choreography. Sorry.
Yeah.
We had to do some fight scenes, and we had to take some films, take some movie shots outside for the introduction. But it was basically in a green screen room, and cameras 360 degrees all around, and also on top. So we make those moves, and our swords, our blades were also covered in, well, this type, not green, but blue. And it was all about those software. And the camera work that they can capture your all your moves.
Oh, so it's like a motion capture.
Just like motion capture, only
it's real.
Only real.
Yeah.
Because they showed us a little bit of our fight scenes on the computer screen, and you can really zoom in into my ear for instance, and the quality is still great. Although all our fancy fighting scenes, because we had to we were a little bit like 17th century closing. So what this American director intended, he was totally successful with our fighting scenes and more. Because now he is trying to edit it more, a little bit shaving it more. So hopefully he can sell the technique and the software to big companies for Hollywood movie productions, for gaming. Just like Hellas Quart, the people of his sword fencing, what you see.
Yeah, Hellas Quart, yeah.
Yeah. But then it is real life and real persons. So you don't have to wear a suit with dots all over you. You just be you, and it really records what the computer, what the camera see.
Incredible.
Yeah, technology.
Yeah.
So, sorry. Yeah.
Sorry, she's trying to stop it. I think Anouk has just answered my next question for you. So my next question was going to be, how did you find your niche? Because like, everyone's got a kind of specific thing that they're into. But I just hear in the comments, Anouk said, yeah, I remember handing a clay wang to this new dude in our club. And look at him now. I've created a monster.
Yes, created a monster. Yes, he's laughing. But before Anouk and I got a relationship, we went to a workshop, and we meet up again there. And she said, "Oh, hey, this guy is a Moroccan guy." So she pulled out her clay wang and gave it to me and said, "Hey, you know this weapon? This is yours, and feel how it like. How do you feel about it?" And then she went off. Nice clay wang. Oh, a group picture. And then suddenly she was gone. But I still had the clay wang. And then luckily I found her, of course, and gave it back. And later on, we got into a relationship, and now we are already 5 years, 5.5 years together.
As long as your HEMA career.
Yeah, I started my HEMA career just a little bit before.
Yeah. So what I was going to say was, like, people listening, people watching may not know about the clay wang.
No.
So that's what we can talk about next. So your name here on, I've called you on Instagram, is the Clay Wang Fence. So you have a page on Facebook, you have a Instagram here. So your thing is the clay wang and the fighting styles that go with that weapon. So tell us about what the clay wang is, where it comes from.
Yes, it comes from clay wang or clay wang, or how do you call it, is a name for a specific type of sword in Indonesia. And why it became Dutch. The Dutch were, Indonesia was a colony called the Dutch Indies at that moment. And we had a army to control and to keep the peace and keep everything in order. Yeah, just keep it. Let's keep it there.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Keep it nice and friendly. And at a certain moment, we got into a war with a province called Aceh. And we went over there, and they were, our soldiers were not properly trained in fencing with a saber, but they had also the very long European sabers, like we all know,
mm-hmm.
the long ones. And they also got rifles called Bowman rifles, and they had bayonets on it. And I am 180 centimeters long, and the rifle is also 180 centimeters long, and then you have a 30 or 45 centimeters long bayonet on it, and it weighed around 5 or 6 kilos. So I'm a big guy, I can handle it, but back in the day, the European people, and especially Indonesian people, I say it Indonesian because native is so strange to say.
Problematic.
Yeah. The local people were just a little bit smaller. So not that very high, not that very big. And carrying around those very long and heavy weapons had some disadvantages against people living there, know the country, know how to use their own swords. And they were very fast and very very handy with their own weapons. So the Dutch army over there, colonial army, they started to lose the war. And also because they are got into a guerrilla warfare. Mm-hmm. So at a certain moment, those soldiers just wanted new weapons, so smaller weapons. And they kind of experimented with weapons because the Dutch were fighting weapons like this one. This is an original Ludus Klimon from Aceh. This is 70 centimeters long, weighs around 700 grams, but the point of balance is 20 centimeters off the hilt. So it is very top heavy. If you look out, mm-hmm. don't damage the aquarium. So they were fighting with those weapons. And at a certain moment, there was a advisor that said, why don't you use the weapons of your enemy? So the Dutch did. The Dutch did what they are very good in, and that is called polderen, polder model. So they used those blades, put it on a European handle, the European handle, and then created a mixture of those two weapons.
Let's have a look. So show us the original grip on the original weapon.
Yeah.
So the first one you showed us.
This is the first one.
Yeah, so it's just an open...
This is a very open handle. Yeah,
just a handle.
No protection or nothing.
Yeah.
And then the typical European, well, Dutch saber. Yeah. This grip.
Yeah.
So one side is protected. The other one has a bowl, a ripped handle of wood, and then a back strap. And then they attach it to the blade. On some old photographs, you can see the weapons combination. And I am lucky to have a friend who had that specific kind of weapon. So I can, at a certain moment, when I have the time, I can look and handle that weapon. And that weapon is a pre-model. Because when they finished testing, they came up with this one. This is a model 1905. The original one, the first one is a model 1895. It looks the same, but the original was, this has a screw, and the original one is riveted in. So that's the only difference. And from that moment on, from 1898, the appearance of a Klimon didn't change until now, actually. And the first military units who were equipped with the Klimon was the Marseillais on foot. Yeah, they were very the very first special forces, because they used the counter guerrilla, they used the guerrilla tactics of their enemy against them. So and that is why they used this light. Well, this is also 700 grams. The point of balance is 15 centimeters. This is still very top heavy chopping weapon. And they used it very effectively because they were given to soldiers who were also inhabitants of Indonesia, but then different parts of the part of the island archipelago. But they were also very accustomed to fighting with this kind of weapons. So they used parangs or glocks or
Oh, we've lost you. Just waiting for you to join again. Hello, you're back.
Hello? Yeah. Suddenly the connection was gone.
The connection went.
Yeah, it went totally dark. Those Marseille on foot were the very first counter-guerrilla units, and they used it very effectively against the Achaean rebels, let's call it. And the the senior command of the Knill army, they recognized the possibilities and also the abilities of that weapon, so they equipped more, and at the end of the Knill, all units were equipped with Klimangs and carbines. Then comes the carbine in the picture. And that is why fencing with Klimang and carbines. Carbines you use at first because you can take out your enemy at a distance, and when they are too close to use the carbine, then you switch to Klimangs. And there are a couple of more reasons why you do it, but long story, and I can talk about
the Klimang and the carbine. The Klimang and the carbine go together, don't they?
Yeah, Klimang and carbine is a combination that goes together. And from that moment on, every soldier liked the Klimang, but also the enemy, if it may call it like that, but also respected the Klimang because it's in the hand of a skilled fighter. Yeah, it's a very fearful weapon, and now it is called a little bit of legendary mythical weapon, and the Moluccan people kind of adopted that as a symbol of their own. Long history.
Sorry, I'm just going to deal with this. Sorry. I have to hold her because she's getting frisky. So, what sources do you use to practice the Klimang?
Yeah, the first source I found, because there are several more, is called, if you maybe people can read it, it is called in Dutch.
You'll have to read it out.
It's in Dutch, and it's called Voorschrift voor de opleiding in het vechten met de blanke wapens, or the VOVBW. In English, it is translated like Regulation for the Training in Fighting with Bladed Weapons. This is a Knill Army regulation from 1937. And why it says bladed weapons, because it teaches you how to fight with the Klimang, but it also teaches you how to fence with the bayonet. So the carbine can also be equipped with a bayonet. This bayonet. But the Knill army was also equipped with rifles to fight other colonial powers like England and also later on the Empire of Japan. So you have two weapon systems, and they combined it in one regulation. And that's a neat kind of thing, because now I can practice with a Klimang, but also do bayonet fencing.
Because you have the sources for it.
Because I have sources. That is one source. I have a couple of more. All Dutch, of course.
Yeah.
And I am studying it to understand what they are saying, but also to understand why they are fighting in that kind of way. Because another regulation, as people who joined, well, followed our workshops in Dijon or in Germany or whatever, wherever, they also found that you can fight it, you can use a carbine as an active parrying shield. And that was also in one of the Dutch regulations. And now I'm trying to find out why they did it and why in a specific way. Because on very old pictures of, well, how do you call it? Cultural study, anthropology.
Anthropology.
You see native warriors standing in the same position like those Dutch soldiers in the regulation. So there must be some kind of connection or inspiration to do it like that. That is also one thing as I'm studying. Yeah, and those are the most main two sources for practicing HEMA.
So, next question. Anouk is already asking it. Show us your favorite clay wang.
Ah, my favorite clay wang. Yeah. I'm also. I have to tell you, I'm also a reenactor.
Yes.
Because, yeah, that follows, of course. I'm depicting a colonial soldier from the period 1937-1942, and 1942 is just before the invasion by Japan. So I can wear clay wang.
Aha.
Now I'm going to open the cabinet.
The cabinet of joy. There it is.
The cabinet of joy. The original weapons of Anouk, the British 1796. Well, you call it this, in Britain, it's called a spadroon, but in Holland, it's called a degen.
Okay.
This is also a light cavalry trooper model number 2, the Dutch army around 1813.
Okay.
A couple of my stage combat fighting weapons and a couple of my clay wangs. And this is my favorite clay wang. It has an original scabbard. It has also an original frog. I'm just closing the door, maybe, so I don't damage it.
Let's have a look. Wow, they're really short.
Sorry?
They're really short, aren't they? I'm used to people pulling out sabers and things, but they are short in the
Total length is 70 centimeters, and the blade length is 62. And the grip is 13 centimeters. Yeah, and so because they are short and they actually do the job, they don't get stuck within all the jungle environments in Indonesia, but also it is short when you have it attached to your leather, to your leather work, it's kind of, I don't know if you know, you can't see it. if you hold it beside your leg, it won't touch the ground.
Yeah.
And that is because it is very short. And also when you go prone or you have to pick up something, or when you are using your carbine and you have to go prone or take a knee, this little frog can swivel. And when you are when you're taking a knee,
yeah,
it swivels and it won't get out of your scabbard. That's also one of those really nice benefits of a short saber. This is my favorite because it is a very complete one. It is also from Hembrug. And Hembrug is a Dutch weapons manufacturer. And that's kind of the holy grail of a kleewang. If you got a kleewang and it says Hembrug, then that is it. You don't want another one. So Hembrug is the one you want. All the other sabers, of course you want all these other kleewangs, but this is the one you really actually want.
The Rolls Royce.
The Rolls Royce. This clear one is
say,
a.
Martin, I just want to say to the folks watching, if anyone has a question for Martin in the comments, please ask us in the comments, or you can hit this button at the bottom of your screen. It looks like a question mark in a speech bubble. Just ask a question. We've got about 20 minutes left. Let me just see if anyone's asked anything here. It's mostly is a nuke. Swords are the best. Back to work. What you were saying, Martin, about swords getting in the way and how the clay wand conveniently folds up when you kneel down and it doesn't get in the way, I really can appreciate that, because at the weekend I went to fight camp here in the UK. It's one of the biggest HEMA events, and on the Saturday night they have a big party and everybody dresses up, and lots of people like to wear swords in the bar, and this is when you find like the fashion accessories start to become a real hindrance, because people are always clanging and banging. Like after a while, like the more crowded the bar gets, and then you start to feel swords and scabbards bashing into your legs and stuff. So having a sword that neatly folds up and doesn't get in the way is a real benefit, even from a sort of a fashion perspective, I think.
Yeah, and your hands are free.
Hands free. You don't have to hold it still.
You don't have to hold it still, because it just stays beside your hip, and it just a little bit swaying backwards and forwards, but it never gets tangled between your legs, or it never pops out of the scabbard. And so, those military people were, they got the use of both hands to do stuff. Mm. They were free. Use the carbine, for instance, because that's a long rifle, so you have to use two hands. So that's one of those benefits why a Kleewang, in my opinion, is one of the best weapons there is.
Absolutely, absolutely.
My favorite weapon. There is no other one.
There is no other weapon. It's the best weapon.
I've
got an absolute flurry of questions here now from.
Okay, shoot.
We'll pretend they're not all from your partner. We'll pretend they're from other people, but I'm going to read them out because they are really pertinent. They're really useful. So, is the Kleewang a cutlass?
No.
No?
No. Because a cutlass is more a navy weapon.
Right.
And because it a cutlass, and I have held cutlasses before, so I know a little bit difference, and I felt it, handling the difference. But the real distinction between a Kleewang and a cutlass is that a Kleewang is made for land-based operations, while a cutlass is more based for navy operations. And the Dutch Navy also used Kleewangs because they needed a new weapon, of course, to replace their old cutlasses. And they have the same length and also a little bit the same weight. The balance point is different. But so I can understand why Navy people used the Kleewang for as a replacement for a cutlass. And also the Americans, they have made their own model 1917 Navy cutlass, but that is basically a converted model 1911 Kleewang.
Oh, really?
It is this one they copied, and they made a bowl because of those cutlasses. They are closed bowls, and named it a cutlass.
So it's an imitation.
Well,
an interpretation.
They did the same thing the Dutch did to the Indonesian people. So they made for their purposes, a good weapon out of an already existing weapon.
Right,
still looks like a Kleewang.
Do other countries have Kleewangs as well?
Yes. So the Americans, they have Claybanks. They also, during the war, manufactured Claybanks for the Dutch Indies Army. At a certain point, the Japanese invaded, and the Dutch army surrendered. So the Americans gave it to their own U.S. Marines because they're already there. They know how to use it. So give it to the U.S. Marines. So Vince and Milsko, those are the names of the American-made Claybanks, were given to U.S. troops. So America, the United States of America, has Claybanks, but also, of course, Indonesia, because Indonesia was part Dutch, and they also use Claybanks.
The original.
The original, the Netherlands got them, and the Indonesians got them, and they still have it in store at local police stations. So,
Oh, really? Do you think there should be HEMA competitions with clay wax?
I really like it, I really like to, but to be honest, you have to practice first because those claymunks, they do hurt.
You've got a custom-made trainer, haven't you?
Because the one of the biggest challenges in studying claymunk is that there are no practice weapons. No steel ones, no the synthetic ones, wooden ones. The Dutch army just used old sabers and cut them down and made them into practice sabers. But until now, there were no practice weapons. So what we did was Peter Frank and I got the idea from Peter Frank from the Vrijvechter in Cologne, Germany, and he just said, "Why don't you take a Rawlings cutlass or Rawlings saber, cut them down, make a nice rounded tip, cut half of the bowl, and then you have a weapon that resembles a claymore." So yeah, at first, when we started out, we used that weapon, but later on, I got in touch with the people of Black Fencer, and I gave them the specifics and I told them what I want, and they made this one. No,
Well,
the
nice. Oh, we've lost connection again. You're back.
I'm back. I just got a notification for someone else trying to log into something.
Okay.
So this is the very first Black Fencer clay one ever made. This is the very first one. But now you also have the gray version. This is a so when you come across the white version, that is the first production line, and the gray one is more a upgraded version because they have new, better synthetics, nylon synthetics. So one of the big challenges was how to make those things, and then we tried out, we made some prototypes, and finally came out with a in between model, and that is now the production line model, Black Fencer Claybanks. And I've seen people use them in claybank fencing, but I also have seen other people use it as a cutlass. That's a fun part of things. I let other people make me training weapons, and now you see that people from all around the world also like it, and they also buy it and use it for their own stuff and naval boarding exercises, for instance.
Barton Gear 9 says it looks like a combination of a cutlass and a machete.
It looks like a combination
Hello?
of a
A
cutlass.
cutlass and a machete.
Ah, yes. Just before I said that the Dutch made a well, it's more like a multi-tool thing because They wanted a weapon that can do the job, so for warfare, but also use it for clearing a path in the bush, or chopping wood, chopping meat, because you have to do stuff. Also those kind of things, and it is used as a machete, and that is why there were a lot of clearings. They had to be sharpened, so every time sharpen, and they got not. They were not military issue anymore because they couldn't fulfill the prescribed regulations, so they were discarded. But they were used as machetes. And the funny thing, Cold Steel from America, that's another company who makes a modern replica of the 1917 Navy Cutlass. They have made a Cutlass machete.
Oh, deal.
And this is a Cutlass machete from Cold Steel.
Cool. Is it sharp?
It is sharp. And I'm intending to use it for test cutting. It has a plastic grip. You can see it like better like that. It has a very common plastic grip, not like the clear one itself. But if you're going to do some test cutting and you make damage to it, it is not that bad as you do it with the original one.
You can be a bit less anxious about it.
First practice with that one and then an original.
Now you I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, are writing a book. With others.
I'm working together with Peter Frank, and Peter Frank is also one of the people who studies fighting with the Klingon and carbine, and like-minded people, they get friends, get befriended, and now he's a very close friend. And Anouk Post, my fiance, is also working on the book, and we three together are working together with Keith Farrell from Fallen Rook Publishing. And we're hoping to publish our transcription of the Fail Faber Way. We are hoping to publish it in the end of the year. And it is not just like a translation, because this is all Dutch. It's not just a translation to English, but it is also a little bit, it tells you historical context. So why did the Klingon use, how was it used, why was it used, when was it used, also a little bit social, economic, and of course, HEMA related. How do you fence with a Klingon? How do you have to do it? What do you have to keep in mind for gear and kit, protective kit? So basically, we're making a transcription, telling about historical context, translate to the original regulation, and also give tips and advice in how people can fence with the Klingon. And the goal is make the Klingon better known, and also let other people study this unique weapon. And the more Klingon fences there are, the better, so we can practice with each other.
Yay! And have tournaments.
And have tournaments. And then get all bruised and battered up and drink beer afterwards.
and eat cheese.
Yeah, and cheese, yes.
So that is being published by Fallen Rook Publishing. Yeah. And when did you say it's coming out?
We hope at the end of this year.
The end of the year. So we all look forward to that. So a couple more questions before we finish up. What is the best part about researching this period of history?
The best part is that you get to get places. So when you're doing some research, you have to find those sources, and they can only be found in knowledge centers of army depots of various kinds of musea. So I went to the National Military Museum in Soesterberg. I went to the National Institute of Military History in The Hague, in the army barrack. I still have to go places, of course, Natural Archive and other Royal Navy Museum, and everywhere they have clearings. Also, Dutch police used clearings until 1968. So those are one of those best parts of doing a study. You also make new friends because other people are also interested. Not only fencers, but also sword collectors, because there is a book out. It's an old book already and slightly a little bit outdated because we are doing study. It is this book, the Clerong book, and it's called Catalogus van het Legermuseum, or Catalogue of the Dutch Army Museum. That army museum doesn't exist. It is being transferred to the National Army Museum. But this book is, I consider it as the Bible of Clerongs, because it tells you also a little bit of military history. It also defines all different kinds of models that you have. There are 20 models known. It is written by Jan-Pieter Puype and also by Robert de Boekwijd Sterling. Those are actual researchers and army museum conservators. They really did make a really good and long study of it. And if you can get a hold of this book or copy, then yeah, none the richer. It tells you everything about Clerongs, not only about the blade itself, but also about the scabbard, the fork, how it was used, different type of manufacturers.
Oh, we lost you again. You're back?
Yeah, I'm back.
My final question for you. Yeah. What is the greatest challenge or challenges about researching and studying the Clerong?
The greatest challenges, because there are more, HEMA-wise, creating a trainer weapon for yourself. So luckily now I have the Black Fencer nylon versions, but I'm also planning to make a steel version that will probably be at the end of the year or next year.
Excellent.
Other challenges are there are not many people around who are who practice Clermont fencing. So yeah, sparring against other people is a big challenge. Historical and collecting wise, it is very, you have to find those sources. So you have to really do the work. It is not just like, oh, I take it from the shelf. No, you have to actually dig into those archives and do some real research. That is very difficult. Networking. And so, all the information from around the world, from Australia, from the UK, from Germany, from Americas, Indonesia, of course, they are all pouring in. We create a little bit of database. So that is a challenge. And also telling people sharing the correct information about the clearing. Because people know certain stuff, but they don't know the whole truth or just a little bit. And also, I had to see some ads by various houses. They use a certain weapon. For instance, a American auction house. And they advertised a Confederate state Georgian artillery hangar from that period, but it actually was a Hi-Ho Cleveland. An Hi-Ho Cleveland is a different model. It was originally a 1911 Cleveland we all know, but the Japanese cut it down to their own specific. So it resembles one of those Tonto weapons, or it's similar like their own weapons, and they gave it to the Indonesian auxiliary forces. And it's called a Hi-Ho, because Hi-Ho stands for National Auxiliary blah, blah, blah for Indonesia during warfare. Those weapons were shipped, of course, as trophy to the Americans, and now they are selling it. Well, that company at that moment was selling it as a Confederate state naval artillery hangar for a lot of money. So we had a little bit of a laugh. So yeah, those are a little bit of challenges to provide the correct information, and hopefully your information and your credibility is good enough to accept it. And yeah, that's a little bit we are all working on to make Cleveland a little bit more known.
So there's fighting with Clay Wangs, there's fighting to make people know more about Clay Wangs, and fighting against misinformation as well.
Fighting against misinformation and also about not knowing information. Because it is really a little bit of a forgotten thing. So taking it back as a reenactor and also as a Hime fencer, I give it a little bit more, make it a little bit more public. People can see and also know about their own history, because it is not only from Indonesia but also Dutch thing, and get a little bit more knowledge from everywhere.
Well, the world's going to know a lot more about it now because you've got this podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And you've got your book coming out end of the year, so we will look to that. Which only leaves me to say, Martin, the Clay Wang fencer, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been really fascinating. And
thank you very much. If there are any questions, just ask. You can find me on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, of course. Look for Clay Wang fencer of the Clay Wang group, and you'll find me.
And I hope to see you in real life soon.
Yeah, it's really cool. We haven't seen each other for so long.
For a long, long time. Okay, take care.
Take care. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To show your appreciation, please give us a 5-star review on your podcast platform, or support our work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/swordwomen. Go to @swordwomen on Instagram to see upcoming interviews, or visit buythesword.net to learn about our events, or visit our Facebook page, By the Sword.